Good morning, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, as I usually am, and today I am joined by the tall and wise Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you, sir?
Good afternoon. Very well.
Yes, yes, yes. And, of course, Mr. Terence Corrigan, who is standing in for Herman, who disappeared on me this morning for some reason. I think he's not at work today. So anyway, not sure what he's doing, but I'm sure it's something interesting and exciting. Terence, how are you?
To quote the second best James Bond, surviving. Just surviving. We all know Roger Moore was the best Bond and Pierce Brosnan was the second best.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Hot takes. Let it never be said that there are not hot takes on the show. yes, and I think I see etched on Gabriel's face a very similar sentiment to what you just said, Terence. Yes, it looks like he's just surviving. Let us get into the terrible news of today, because unfortunately that seems to be most of the news we're getting at the moment. But the latest unemployment figures have come out for South Africa, and they have risen to, I think, some of the highest ever recorded. The official unemployment rate has risen to 34.4% between April and June, up from 32.6%. That means on the official definition, which does not include people who have given up searching for work, there are 7.8 million people unemployed. Under the expanded definition, which includes those so-called discouraged work seekers or discouraged workers, the unemployment rate is up to 42.6%, meaning we're just under 12 million people jobless. The Eastern Cape, somewhat unsurprisingly, recorded the highest both official and expanded unemployment rates of any province. And interestingly, Limpopo and the Northern Cape have more than 15 percentage points differences between their expanded and official unemployment rates. This is a thing we've, of course, bashed on many times. Because it is the big problem in South Africa. Gabriel, you, of course, ran the Racism is Not the Problem campaign. This seems to be the problem. Do you have anything to say, really, about this? What we can do, why this is happening, and, yeah, Gabriel, take it away.
Yeah, I mean, I think why it's happening is pretty clear, but the basics are that work is almost inevitably a mixture of time, talent, and tools. And the way that tools get to mix with labor to increase productivity so that you get an income out of it is through protecting the relationship between tools and tool owners that incentivizes the tool owners to keep the tools where they are, to keep them sharp, and to make more tools so that more people can work with more tools to make more things. That relationship is called property rights. And that relationship is fundamentally existentially threatened. But before the existential threat, there's this sort of like just the qualitative threat. So while expropriation without compensation hasn't happened yet, a variety of interventions have happened to make it so. The policy point that I like to pick out is the minimum wage. You know, I just was thinking about this again over the weekend. Vox, which is a self-described kind of left-wing American explainer channel run by Ezra Klein. It's really sweet. It's clearly super left-wing. They have a piece on the minimum wage and how the minimum wage in America is not great because it's not tied to inflation. So it doesn't increase automatically as inflation goes up. And then they pull out a chart of 40 countries' minimum wages. And they say this is the minimum wage relative to the median wage. The median wage is the middle person's salary. If you lined everyone up, what's the middle person's salary? And on this chart, you see the lowest is America. It's at 25%. And the highest is like, I don't know, Spain or something, and it's at like 40%. So the highest minimum wage that they can find is 40% of the median wage. And they say at this level, you don't have to worry about creating unemployment. At this level, the minimum wage is a really good idea. At this level, you should tie it to inflation so that it ratchets up stably and securely rather than kind of move through negotiations that politicize it and that it's unpredictable for business. Okay, that's fascinating. What is South Africa's minimum wage? It is equal to our median wage. Our minimum wage was set to price 50% of the labor market out of work. In a country that has at least twice as high unemployment as any of the other countries on Vox's list of 45 countries. In short, we've got the craziest minimum wage, but that's just one small policy and one that's only been recently implemented. I think the last point that I'll make is, what does this portend going forward? I don't think that the story is going to get a lot of enthusiastic coverage. I think people are not going to be surprised. I think news anchors are going to repeat it. They're going to give one or two sound bites, and then they're going to want to move on, because who really wants to hear about more unemployment? But something is changing, in my opinion, and it's the incentive for those in power. The incentive has been, and no one has done a better job than the Institute of Race Relations from 1994 through 2020. To say that the best route for the ANC to hold on to power is to implement those policies which will increase jobs, which will increase the material standards of living of ordinary South Africans, who will reward it as they have rewarded it before for such increases in standards of living with the vote. That incentive structure, I believe, has changed or is changing. And this unemployment figure reflects that. It's hard to find a country ever that's had unemployment rates like this that hasn't become riotous, consistently kind of failed democracy. And I'm not saying it's impossible to bounce back, but I am saying that it might very well be easier for the party in charge to hold on to power by going full on authoritarian, by abandoning the pretense that this is still a democracy under the rule of law, in which property rights, human rights, civil rights, and so on are protected, and to go for broke and just say, you know what, we're going to take everything we can. Everyone who disagrees is an enemy of the state, and chucky for you.
Okay, well, that's a really good segue for our second topic, and I'm very annoyed now that you've put it here while we still haven't heard from Terrence, but anyway. I see also someone in the comments is saying that Terrence is the only one here who does not look like a Taliban supporter. I would shave my beard, but then you'll see my double and triple chins, so I'm not going to do that. Terrence, Gabriel's just laid out, I think, a very good case as to the madness of the situation that we're in. And to add to that madness, I was talking to my father, who's a DA MP, this morning. He was talking about the Minerals Committee or something like that. I can't remember. And he basically said there's enthusiasm for only one policy in government at the moment, and that is transformation. And joblessness is very much considered second fiddle to that. Your thoughts, Terrence?
Well, first of all, I'm glad that I'm not being identified with the Taliban. I'm certainly, not a Taliban supporter. And I do hope that the state of my numerous chins does bear that out. And there are a few places I would less rather be today than Kabul. We should count our blessings that we are
definitely agree with that 100%
in our pleasantly dysfunctional South Africa, where we may have many problems, but Taliban rule is not imminent. To answer your question directly, look, we've been struggling with unemployment as a major issue since pre-democracy. This was one of the issues that the bad old government identified in the 1980s as being latched on by these dreadful insurrectionists. And, you know, we've got to make sure that people have jobs. Unfortunately, the conditions that would be required to address that, you know, have just never been put in place. And I think there's a wonderful meeting of minds between the old regime and the new on this. Sympathy for enthusiasm for small business, for instance, has always been more rhetorical than real. You know, that's why we've ended up with things like bargaining councils. While we have numerous bodies dedicated to supporting small business, which, you know, produce nothing of any real value. Secondly, the baleful quality of education that a lot of young people get, and that's why you'll see the bulk of the problem is amongst younger people who simply can't get a foot into the economy in the first place. But, you know, while I think that we take a major risk with minimum wages and hiking the cost of employment, that might still be doable if everything else was congenial. If, for instance, we had firms didn't have to invest masses in security costs, if we had functional local governments, if there were opportunities to sort of make a mint by exploiting a large domestic or regional market, all of these things might be able to compensate. I mean, a country like Germany or Sweden, you know, they've got their unemployment problems, but it's not a patch on what we have. And the cost of labor there is very, very expensive, but it's very productive labor, and it's within an environment where doing business is simply less challenging. Yes, you know, Germany is regulated up to the hilt, but you know, but I know this from experience. Sort of every German official knows exactly what to do. It's quite fascinating sometimes. I lived in Taiwan. Contrary to popular belief, Taiwan is not entirely freewheeling. You know, sort of freewheeling Wild East situation. The Chinese culture has a long tradition of bureaucrats who sit there with their, you know, 20 stamps in front of them. But the point is, the guy will speak to you in, you know, pidgin English or broken Japanese, as well as Chinese or whatever local variant he's using, and he will know exactly where to put your stamps and off you go. This is not an experience that most entrepreneurs face in the Wild South. So, you know, you know, at the end of the day, you have to deal with the circumstances and the labor force you have, not the one that you wish you had.
Very, very well put. I want to go off a little bit of a tangent that's sort of related, and Terrence mentioned how we have poor educational outcomes. And we've mentioned this on the show before, and I've seen occasionally some people push back in the comments against this. And I've also seen organizations like Africa Check sort of fact check claims that South Africa has amongst the worst education in the world and say, no, it's not really proven. And I remember a specific Africa Check article which said something along the lines of they were rating a claim that I think from AfriForum that South Africa had some of the worst education in the world. And it said, well, look, this survey they're referencing here, AfriForum, is not entirely accurate. It's much better to look at standardized test scores. But of course, if you look at standardized test scores, South Africa consistently ranks near the bottom of the countries tested. The other thing that Africa Check said was something along the lines of, no, you see, South Africa is not so bad because not every country in the world is surveyed. So we're only at the bottom of a list of 100 countries or 75 countries or whatever. And I actually was just looking this fact up now, and, you know, just a few years ago, South Africa ranked in the bottom 10 of countries on standardized test scores in maths and science education. All right, Gabriel, I don't know if you have anything
more. We get beaten by the Palestinians.
It's like everyone. I mean, we're just behind Ghana and ahead of countries like Honduras. Gabriel, do you have any final thoughts on this topic before we move on?
The only point on that is that what's most interesting, and the Economist did a good job on this, was that their headline finding on South Africa's education system was that it's the world's worst bang for buck.
Yes.
We spend for amongst peer economies, economies with similar GDPs per capita, we spend just about the highest proportion of GDP on education.
It's like 25% or something, isn't it? Somewhere around there.
It's the highest line item. The second highest line item on the budget is servicing debt. So we're spending a lot of money to get such poor outcomes. And I think that speaks to the broader malaise, is that everything the government touches kind of gets worse. And then they say, okay, give us more money. And then that makes everything worse. And then they get to touch more things. And then that makes everything worse. And then you get this tragic situation where, like, this country is worse off than it was a decade ago, which is just crazy.
You know, the late Lawrence Schlemmer said, and this is about 20 years ago, that he wished the problem with our education was a lack of resources, because then the solutions are simple. Put more money in. But he said, okay, first of all, this doesn't hold up internationally, but secondly, it doesn't hold up in South Africa. There are, previously DET schools, Department of Education training schools, township schools, whatever, that actually perform fairly well. That owes a lot to committed management, to teachers who take their responsibilities seriously. I think where I would come to the partial defense of Africhek as I understand the critique, and sometimes the critique made of South Africa's education by South Africans themselves, is that they will look at World Economic Forum data, which often relies on particular opinions. How well do you rate the quality of education in your country? Now, the important thing to bear in mind
your staff.
That is contextual. Nobody is going to go to the DRC expecting to find
a lot of literacy.
Yeah, well, or a highly educated, highly innovative workforce. It's not what you're going to get there. But perhaps, you know, perhaps the education system can produce basic literacy and numeracy for the type of activities that investors are looking for. That might be enough. South Africa is in a different position. You know, we have a sophisticated and advanced economy. It's part of it. But we are not pushing through these skills that are needed to sustain and expand it. So you find yourself in a dreadful position that there are actually sectors of the economy where there are vacancies, you know, a lot of the digital stuff, but it's just vanishingly hard to find the people to fill those positions. And unfortunately, the idea, well, you're going to throw training at it. That I think works if you have people who have the sort of basic educational foundation to build on, but often that is so abysmal that you're dealing with it's not just poor education, it's a kind of educational pathology, and the squandering of human capital is criminal.
No, definitely, and to tie this back into a neat little bow, we're not really going to solve some of the long-term unemployment problems. I mean, obviously, property rights is a huge part of solving that problem, but the other part is improving our education system. And until we solve those problems, we're not really going to get to the heart of it.
I just want to make one more point. It's not so much that we need it to be excellent, although that would be
nice.
That would be optimal. We just kind of need it to be good enough.
Yeah,
we don't get there.
Yeah, no, I agree. So someone is asking in the comments, we know the government sucks, but what are we going to do about it? Well, one of the things that people can do in a system such as ours when they're not happy with the way things are going is exercise their voice in elections. And of course, as any of you who have been following the show for a while know, this is a bit of a problem at the moment because the IEC is looking to postpone our elections till at least February, possibly later. And yesterday we talked a little bit about how the ANC's election lists, its lists of candidates, are they're causing problems inside the party, but they have now, I believe, submitted them to the IEC saying, here's our candidates for the four across the country. Jesse Duarte of the ANC said, we didn't ask for a change of deadline. We're very happy if there is one, but we're completely ready to go ahead for 27th October for the local government elections if they are in fact not postponed by the court. Gabriel, you've been following the court case around this issue very closely that the IRR is involved in. What are your thoughts on this?
So this, what's really important here is there's so many different arguments being thrown against the wall in terms of why postponement should be allowed. One of the arguments was that none of the political parties will be able to get their lists together of candidates in each ward. And the deadline for that was yesterday. The argument was made to the court on Friday. All of the parties, as far as I can tell, have gotten their lists together and have submitted their candidates. After the fact, the ANC says, no, we never wanted postponement. But before the fact on Friday, they said to the court, we do want postponement. And one of the reasons we want postponement is because we can't get our lists together. EFF said the same thing. Amazingly, they said basically they can't do it because they don't have enough money for data or logistical news. And the ATM party, which is a new sort of, it was described as a Zuma faction party when it first came into power, emerged.
I love the name, ATM party.
They said, these other parties are complaining, but we've got our act together. We've got a candidate ready in every ward in the country. So that sort of humiliated the ANC and the EFF. I don't know why they've decided to change their tune. It's kind of ridiculous that they have. It's very good though, because it does make it harder still for the election to be postponed. Now that the parties are being forced to do this. But I think it's important to note that there's something really gross that happened where the court was told by senior counsel, Wim Trengrove, a man of great reputation representing the Electoral Commission, that all of the parties, all of the political parties, he said this at least three different times, and I've got the quotes, rejected the Electoral Commission's timetable. In other words, said you have to postpone the election because they can't get their lists together in time. He said that. That is not true. That was never true. Some of the political parties did oppose it on that basis, like the ANC. Now they say they never did, so that's just them lying. But some of the political parties, like the DA, said, no, we oppose this thing because you've closed the voters' roll before registration weekend was allowed, which was promised. And three different times, a senior counsel said to the Constitutional Court that all of the parties opposed the timetable because of one particular reason, namely they can't get their list together, which is a misrepresentation before the Constitutional Court. And it's just one example of several where so desperate has the ANC, the IEC, the EFF, the Cochter minister and company been to gum up the wheels of electoral democracy so that they might clank and clamor and so that this election might be delayed while South Africans are very irritated, so that the ANC might avoid dropping below 50%. And just remember that the key thing here is that in some wards, incumbents might be voted out. And that can mean the difference between so many potholes that a factory has to move and all those jobs get lost, and actually the road working well enough that the factory can still operate, or the electricity being restored in time for the factory to still operate, and so on and so forth. That can be the difference for some wards. But no one pretends that the ANC is going to be voted out of all of the wards that it's mismanaging. And no one pretends, no one should pretend that there's any party that could take over all the wards in this country right now and make them work effectively. The major issue is, outside of the particular wards, is the national question of what happens when the ANC drops below 50%. And I did say when, not if. If we get an election, there's an if. But when the ANC drops below 50%, a psychological shift will take place, in my opinion, both within their minds, within the minds of the population, and in the minds of the tastemakers in the media. And therein one finds a very good reason to try and postpone the elections, because maybe they stand a chance next year. I don't think they stand a chance right now of holding on to that 50%. Maybe they do. Maybe I'm overestimating South Africans' reasoned responsiveness to the crisis that we're in. But that's where it seems to lie. And I think this desperation has just gotten to the stage of brazen misrepresentations of the court. And in South Africa, I don't know that that happens very often. I have followed constitutional court cases, and usually that's one of the very few places. You know, there's potholes outside, the traffic lights don't work outside the court. But once you get inside the court, it gets professional. Not on this case.
I must say it's strange that, so, you know, how did this whole thing start? It starts because this commission that the IEC sets up says, oh, we can't possibly hold the elections now during a time of COVID, so we need to break the constitution effectively in order to make sure that they're free and fair. And yet now parties are bringing arguments about how they don't have the organizational capacity to select candidates to get their lists together.
The Electoral Commission said the big problem is we don't have budget for personal protective equipment.
Well, that seems like a relatively easy fix.
Terrence, so can you break the Constitution?
Yeah, can you break the Constitution because we haven't budgeted correctly? Terrence, your thoughts on what Gabriel's just been laying out?
Well, I think Gabriel's done an excellent job. I'll just reiterate that the bare minimum condition of being a democracy is having an election. You know, we don't have an election when, you know, we're not a democracy. Now, I may be going back to sort of first principles, you know, grade five stuff, you know, but maybe there's people in the, I don't know, the IEC, the government, that need to be reminded of this, that actually elections are important. They're important things. You know, we don't want to just dispense with our elections. And, you know, if organizations that aspire to run the country can't manage their own internal processes sufficiently to participate in said elections, that does say something about their suitability to run the country.
Yes, exactly. They're making the argument against themselves. They're saying we're too poor, too dysfunctional, too disorganized, and too inept to figure out how to operate in a situation where we have to stand 1.5 meters from each other. We don't know how to do that. We don't know how to canvass door to door while standing 1.5 meters away. I don't know how to talk to someone unless I'm on top of them. Please, can you delay the election so that next time I have to go and canvass door to door, I can hug the person because I can't do any other way. If there was a business that said we want force majeure, which is what they're calling for, an impossibility doctrine, this is completely impossible. The factory has been burnt down, so we can't deliver you your stuff. There was a company that said, look, we don't know how to operate under socially distanced conditions. Because like we're a bank and we don't know how to keep counting your money with masks on. It's too confusing for us. That bank would be laughed out of business immediately. We should laugh. These guys are making the argument against themselves. They're saying they're too inept to run a campaign.
Even more than that, saying, oh, we can't have the election because our specific political party is in such a state. It's like, I missed the part where that became our problem, right? To quote the old Spider-Man movies. It's just such incredible duplicitous madness. And I you know, the ANC is very...
Dude, but they can't pay their staff. I mean, they really can't run an election. The ANC can't pay their own staff. The ANC can't pay Ipsos to do their polling. They're being sued by Ipsos now for not being paid since 2019. Right. The ANC really can't run the ANC. My favorite thing is when Jesse Duarte said, we've got our lists up, 25% of the people that have been nominated for wards are youth. But please don't get us confused yet. This is not how we're trying to grow jobs. This is not a... Ward councillors are not a job growth opportunity. It's such a weird thing to try and have to explain.
Isn't there a phrase about breweries somewhere around here? Somewhere.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that is the time, towards the end of the time. Just a reminder, you know, the IRR is part of this court action to try and make sure that the election does, in fact, go ahead. Supporting the reservations is a way to kind of support your rights to vote, as Gabriel will tell you, as he is our head of campaigns. But anyway, yeah, if you'd like to
support we made a very important argument before the Constitutional Court. In my opinion, we posed the last line of defense.
Which you can hear about if you listen to the Two Crickers and a Thorn Tree podcast, which I think has just gone up today because we had some technical problems. But anyway, yeah, that'll be around thedailyfriend.co.za, which you should check out if you don't. Also, if you want to support the Institute of Race Relations, please go to irr.org.za and click the Join Us button, or alternatively, SMS your name to 32823, and we'll call you back to sign you up as a friend of the Institute. Anyway, we hope you enjoyed the show. We hope you thought it was interesting, entertaining, and sobering, and all that good and not so good stuff. And
keep surviving.
Keep surviving. Have a wonderful day, everyone. We'll see you tomorrow.